Okay, so we continue in Acts chapter 24. So we have pretty much just started Acts chapter 24 last week and had talked somewhat about Tertullus. Who's Tertullus? All right, so he was the speaker that spoke for the Jewish people, not necessarily an attorney, but one that was a good talker. So he kind of talked up the governor there, whose name is what? Felix. Okay. So he spoke good words to him, and I'm sure that Felix was highly impressed, knowing that this was a orator that was hired to butter him up. We talked about that and the fact that they were accusing him of being a pestilent fellow and a mover of insurrections and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, that he says that he tried to profane the temple, and that, let me see, what else? And so they laid hold on him then. Interestingly enough, during one of the other discussions that Paul had with the Sanhedrin court, really none of this came up. They just had a big shouting match, apparently, with amongst themselves, so Paul didn't really engage in that. He just, you know, pointed out a fact to them. And kind of interesting to note that the charges kind of change every time we come to a different court. I wanted to look at a few of the things because, as some of you might know, I like to look at sort of the big picture, as it were, literally speaking. And so if we look at the map of the world and go around to the other side where all of these things take place, we understand that this is approximately the area in which most of the stuff that's written in the Bible takes place. And when we go a little closer, we understand that rather than, you know, Mickey's two ovals and a line, here's the Mediterranean, here's the Sea of Galilee, and here's the Dead Sea. We have here a picture of that showing, you know, this is pretty much the extent of the land of Israel. Not very big as far as we're concerned. I think, as I recall, it's smaller than the state of California in square mileage. I didn't bother to look that up. But you'll remember that as we were discussing at the end of chapter 23, as Paul was being taken from Jerusalem, that they ventured out here to Antipatris and then ventured on up to Caesarea, which is on the coast, Antipatris not being on the coast. I was looking here at Antipatris a little bit, trying to just get an idea of, what kind of topography do we have there? So this, I think, is part or some of the old town of Antipatris, just the ruins that they have there. Does this word Antipatris sound familiar at all? Herod Antipater, right? Was one of the Herods. And so when I think Felix, or one of the governors, caused this town to be built, one of the relatives of Herod caused this town to be built, he named it Antipatris after his uncle or grandfather or whatever he was. But anyway, after his patron. Yes, Randy?
There, it's also a very historical location, the town of Aphek.
Yes.
It's very close by there. And it was where the Israelites had fought the Battle of Ebenezer. First one they lost the Ark.
Right.
The covenant there.
Right.
And the second one they were able to defeat the Philistines.
Okay, so yes, this was sort of a Philistine encampment way back then, and Aphek, which apparently was in this area, was the place where the Ark of the Covenant was taken by the Philistines. The Philistines did not have a lot of luck with said Ark of the Covenant after they took it home. What happened to them? They took it to their capital city. What happened there?
Dagon fell on his face.
A couple of times.
Yeah.
Broke him and all that sort of stuff. What happened to the people? They got some sort of plague and said, okay, well, let's take it from the capital city and take it to another city. Everybody was, yay. They took it to the other city, and what happened to them? They got the plague also. And so I think they took it to a third city, and they finally came to the conclusion this wasn't a really good idea. And so they put the ark back on the on a cart and sent it back up. Now, what's the unusual thing about how they determined whether the ark needed to go home?
They put an oxen or a cow with a calf, and they tied the cow to the cart, and the cow wound up going down the road, leading the calf.
Leaving the calf behind, right. So they knew that this was a sign from God that the ark didn't belong in their cities, that's for sure. And so they took it back. I'm not sure, I didn't look it up, but this may be the place, this may be the cart on which it was on when they attempted to move it in Uzzah.
No, that was later.
That had to be later, yeah, because that would have been in David's time, right? Or shortly before David's time. So I'm going to make you dizzy here. But if I tilt this down and look, you can see that the topography doesn't look particularly hilly or anything right there. So we're on the coastal plain by the time we get here. So you can see back as we look toward the east back here that now we're seeing what they refer to as mountains and we refer to as hills, right? So the biggest mountains over here are less than 3,000 feet tall. So we live at almost that elevation. Susan has where they live in Bowling Green, they have a hill that's like 300 feet tall behind them, and they call that a mountain. So anyway, but yeah, she's from here. She knows it's not a mountain, but they still refer to that. And that as we spin around and look toward the direction that the ocean is, everybody dizzy yet?
Yes.
I should think so. So there's the ocean way out there on the horizon. So if you're down at the level of Antipatris, you're not really looking, you don't really have an ocean view type thing. So, but it's there in the coastal plain. It's obvious from what you can see in modern times that agriculture occurs there. And then after Antipatris, of course, they went on to Caesarea, which puts us out toward the coast then, and this is where some of the ruins of old Caesarea are. And you can see right in this area where there's a harbor, but all of this is really man-made harbor. This one too. So these jetties that come out here and the things, there wasn't really anything available for them to use as a harbor. So they built one. I think it was one of the Herods built one of them. You'll remember that at the end of this chapter, when they put Paul in ward, they put him in the palace or whatever. I think it was of Herod, wasn't it? Unless I'm missing the name. But okay. So anyway, so that's where we are, relatively speaking. And remember that even though we would consider these distances to be rather insignificant to us, it's still about 65 miles. So when they left Jerusalem on the evening that they left, it took them until, you know, the next day essentially to get to Antipatris, which is a good, I don't know, 30, 40 miles away. Of course, fortunately, their route would have been mostly downhill, and so that would have helped things out a bit. And then from Antipatris to Caesarea, about the same distance along the coastal plain. There were, of course, and we studied this in our history and geography of the Bible story, a coastal road that goes along here that they probably would have just popped over to and taken that up to Caesarea rather than trying to go cross country. So that's where we are. And so the story now is taking place here in the city of Caesarea, named after Caesar Augustus, I think. I'm not positive, but anyway. And you'll remember also that we discussed a couple of weeks ago that it's also called Caesarea Maritima or Caesarea Palestina. And so you'll see a number of references to it in extra-biblical works. I had another little shaded relief map of the area of Israel. And so you'll see here where it mentions Aphek. So Aphek or Antipatris. And then Caesarea is up here somewhere. They have all these towns from the Old Testament times. So, but you see Jerusalem here is sort of on the spine of the mountain range it runs through. So Jerusalem certainly is high. And, relatively high. It's like 2,500 feet. So that's maybe 200 feet above where we are right now. It certainly isn't the highest place in the entire range. I mean, this place is higher. These places are higher. When it mentions going up to Jerusalem or down to Jerusalem, still, we're essentially doing that. Any place we go from Jerusalem is essentially downhill from there. So most of the places that you go are of lower elevation than Jerusalem. I think also there's a certain amount of, priority given to Jerusalem to indicate that we go up to Jerusalem. It's the capital. It's the seat of the Jewish religion, you might say, and certainly the seat of the capital of Israel. So that's what the area around there looks like. It's certainly not, if you compare that to a look of California, for example, you would see much more rugged mountains than that. So now we had mentioned that this is Paul's third of five defenses. And I put up a slide here back in May sometime when we were talking about Paul's second defense. And so James, of course, will be able to tell us all about this. But as we go through this, we understand that this that we're talking about now in chapter 24 is Paul's third defense. The first one, where's the first one? Before the people on the steps of the temple court, right? Just as they arrested him. Yeah, Acts 22. And then now, where's the second one?
Before the court in
23. In 23. That's just tough because they're in order. 22, 23, 24, and so on. And then the third one, we ought to get this one. Where's the third one? Before Felix in 24. In what city? Caesarea. Okay. And then, now, we've got others that come along. How about the fourth one?
25 before Festus, also in Caesarea.
Okay. So then Festus comes along. Why did Festus come along?
Because Felix was done with his time as governor.
That's right. So Felix was done with his sentence in Caesarea. I'm sure that he thought of it that way. And Festus took over. And did we already mention about how long after this time period it was? About 2 years, right? So, and then, what's the fifth one?
Or Agrippa, also Caesarea.
Also Caesarea. So that's right, James, right? 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26. Five defenses starting in chapter 22 and going on through. So, two of them take place in Jerusalem, and three of them take place in Caesarea. We've got that down now. We'll never forget that, right? Now, as we... Mickey wanted to go through this, and he had mentioned this last week about the fact that Paul had gone through and given essentially, not a day-by-day account, but he had accounted for all the days between when he came to Jerusalem and when he got to Caesarea. I had to give a deposition for an accident that I saw. And so on Friday, I had to go and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and all that sort of stuff. And they wanted me to tell them how long it was between this incident and that incident. After the car left this lane and got into this lane, how much time was that? And after you saw it swerving, then how much time was that? After the accident was done, how much time was that? They want to know. They want a timeline. And Paul here, essentially before a court, the court of Felix, is providing them with a certain timeline. So when we look at this, the context that we have of verses 10 through 21, he's giving a brief description of what he's done in the time. Now, why is he doing this?
To show that there was no time for this other stuff. He
certainly didn't have time to invoke an insurrection. What was it? Claudius Lysias thought that maybe he was the Egyptian, right? Or he was one of the assassins. But not Sergius Paulus, just Claudius Lysias. Randy?
I think it's important to understand what it is that Paul's being accused of here. Herlus is saying that he's really guilty of is he's just a rabble-rouser. Wherever this guy goes, he stirs up trouble. And riots and problems just follow this guy. And it's just his nature that he causes this. Now, there's a lesson for us in there today. The gospel of Christ is revolutionary. And it's going to cause difficulties because it demands a decision from anyone that hears it. And that it's not Paul that's doing this directly. It's the gospel that's forcing people to have to decide who they're going to serve.
Right. The gospel is going to force people to decide. And we see that later on when we're talking about when Felix and Drusilla are there together, Paul is talking to them. It was causing them to have to come to some conclusions.
And if we are not generating the same, I guess, I'm wanting to avoid the word riotous. That's too extreme.
Turbulence?
We're not generating the same uneasiness, yes, in other people, then we have to ask ourselves why.
Okay, right. We certainly do. The interesting thing to note, and I think Mickey pointed this out last week also, is that indeed trouble did occur almost everywhere that Paul went. I mean, if we look at the first journey, right, he left Antioch of Syria and went through Cyprus, right? Make sure I get to Crete. Which one is it? Crete or Cyprus? Crete, right? Whatever.
Cyprus was first.
Cyprus? Okay. And, So he went through Cyprus, and then after he was done preaching there, then he went up to the coast of Asia Minor and eventually got to Antioch of Pisidia. The Jews there didn't like him at all, did they? And so there was a sort of a uproar to speak of right there. Then he goes down to Iconium. What happened there? Stoned and left for dead. So they didn't like him there either. And then he went on to Derbe. And then he ended up coming back to Iconium and back through Antioch and back down. And then when he got to the coast, then he took a ship directly, as it were, to Antioch of Syria. And so we see even on the first preaching tour that he had, disturbances followed him. And it had to be because people's consciences were being examined. And just as even as Paul said before the Sanhedrin, I've lived in all good conscience up until this day, Paul said the thing not only as a Christian, but as a Jew. So as a Jew, he lived all up in all good conscience until he saw the light on the road to Damascus. And then he realized that his conscience was wrong and it needed to be changed, and he did. And so later on, when we get further on here in chapter 24, we'll see that it provoked a similar sort of feeling, you might say, in Felix and perhaps Drusilla. We don't see anything about Drusilla, I think, regarding that. But we do see that Felix, at least, was concerned about the things. He was frightened, it says. And so I think that his conscience was pricking him to a certain extent, though not as much, you might say, as those in Acts chapter 2 who were pricked in their hearts and turned to God. So as we go through this, as Paul's explaining himself now, he's responding to these charges that Tertullus has made. And so he's in an official court of law, as it were. I mean, Felix is standing in judgment in front of him. At this time, they know that Paul is a Roman citizen, but he has not yet proclaimed his right to take his trial before the Caesar. That comes later. So Paul mentions, as we look, let's just read through verses 10 through 20. Someone read verses 10 through 20, please. Jenny, you got it? Yes, Acts 24.
And when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now after several years I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. Some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation should they have anything against me, or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing, that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day."
All right, so Paul has laid out the timeline here of what's going on. He says it's not more than 12 days. Now, we might say that we understand that when we get to the beginning of this chapter, it says, "And after 5 days, the high priest Ananias and such came down." So we've got a five-day thing there. But the fact of the matter is that, as we see here on day one, Paul meets with James and the elders at Jerusalem, and supposedly at this time he delivers the funds that the Gentiles put together. And then on day two, he meets with the elders of the church there in Jerusalem. At that time, they ask him to take charge of the four men that had a vow, which could have been a Nazarite vow, but it doesn't say, so it would be difficult to say. But and then Mickey's got down here at day 3 through 9, he fulfilled the vow. That may be, or it could have been, I don't remember whether the timeline in chapter 21 indicates that it was the next day after he met with the elders that he did this. It may very well have been. But we certainly here see that the timeline of about 12 days is correct, because this, on day 3, is when we're talking about worshiping at the temple. And that's what Paul was talking about right here. So we have a 12-day outline here. So as we look at this, then in chapter 21, we're seeing that Paul arrives, that he delivers the funds that he was supposed to deliver and meets with the elders of the church there in Jerusalem. And then days 3 through 9, and that's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, that's 7 days. So that's what they were supposed to do, was take the 7 days to fulfill their vow. I went back to Leviticus and Numbers and looked that up, and the Nazarite vow did not include anything about a 7-day end of vow period. But there were others that talked about, I believe there are other vows that were mentioned, and some of them included a cleansing period or end of vow period where they had to do certain things. But so there were these things that he was going through. And so what Mickey likes to point out, and I think it's important for us to look at least peripherally, is that did he violate anything as a Christian in doing this? No. I mean, he can do this. I mean, he was just doing it essentially to help these men. And in order to help these men, he certainly had to be able to go into the temple properly. So he had to be properly cleansed. He had to be sanctified, as it were, to fulfill the vow. And I notice it says that he fulfilled his vow, but I'm not sure that he took the vow. I think that he just went in to be at charges for them. At the end of the 7 days, then, their vow termination period was over, and they could have then shaved their heads or whatever they needed to do. But at that time, then, what happens then on day 9? The last day of the vow period. Paul is in the temple.
He gets accused of taking Gentiles.
Yeah.
And they get mad and they mock him.
Specifically, whom did they say that he took?
Trophimus.
Because apparently people knew that he was from Ephesus, right? I believe Trophimus was from Ephesus. He's at this time, he's taken essentially by the Jews, and they commenced to beating him severely, because it looked like he could lose his life in this. Claudius Lysias then, of course, comes down to break up this riot that's going down here and rescues him, because he already knows that he's a Roman citizen, right? Because that's what his letter said. No. So he went down.
As Tertullus said, with great violence.
With great violence. That's right. And said, we would have judged him ourselves. What is this? Verse 7, isn't it?
Which chapter?
Yeah, chapter 24. The last part of verse 6 and 7, it says, and we would have judged him according to our law, but the chief captain Lysias came and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come before thee. I'm thinking, you accuse Claudius Lysias of great violence? You're trying to beat this man to death. He needed to use great violence in order to even get to Paul. And once he did get to Paul, then what did he do? Bound him, right? Says with two chains. Took him up the stairs into the guardhouse, barracks, castle, whatever different translation that you have. I forgot the name of the place, but it's not important. So it joins, as it were, hard onto the northwest wall of the Temple Mount. They go up the stairs there, and Paul then has his brief discussion with his brethren while on the stairs. You see. So as we look at then at the end of chapter 21, we understand that they're taking him away up to the barracks. And then in chapter 22, a good portion of that chapter is then Paul explaining to the Jews below him in the temple courtyard what's going on as far as his life goes. And then he mentions that faithful word. What is that one faithful word that he mentions? Well, there was that, but he didn't mention it at that time.
Resurrection.
That would have been before the council, but as he's on the stairs, Gentiles, right? Says, oh, send me to the Gentiles. Interesting to note, as I thought about that, is that the Old Testament has numerous passages indicating that God will bring his word to the Gentiles. It would be sort of a puzzlement as to why they would consider this particularly egregious. Yeah, Randy?
Well, it was the how. They figured that, okay, the Gentiles can come in, but they got to essentially become Jews.
Under our terms, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and as we had discussed before, by this time, by the time of Paul's time here, they were spending a whole lot more time trusting in their extra-biblical sources than they were in the scriptures themselves. And so there was a lot of things that they did or believed or thought should happen that were not things that God had put forth, but things that they themselves had put forth in their history. All right. Then on day 10, as Paul is talking, he's talking about what's going on. Then they bring him before the Sanhedrin Council. This is where Paul then is accused, but it's kind of difficult to see that they actually bring any charges against him. All they do is sort of yell at him, and then Paul had attempted to make his defense by saying what? I've lived before God in all good conscience up until this day. And then the chief priest commands him to be slapped, right? So he slaps him. And then Paul is informed that this is the chief priest. There's certainly a bit of controversy in the commentaries as to why didn't Paul know that this was the chief priest? Well, when this council was called together at the commandment of Claudius Lysias. And so he says, council, come together. I got a guy. I'm coming down with a gazillion soldiers, and we're going to bring him here into the council chamber, and you're going to judge him. And so we don't know what time of the day or night this was. We assume it's during the day. And certainly the Sanhedrin Council was in session during the weekdays, you might say, of any given day. But this looks like it was a command of performance. So indeed, you know, they may have all still been in their sweatshirts and blue jeans from, you know, being at the gym or whatever. So we may not know, but have been able to determine what the difference between any of the people were. Paul apparently didn't know that the man that had commanded him to be slapped was the chief priest.
I don't think he would have said stuff he said.
A little bit. Not too bad. It wasn't, yeah. You know. Whited wall and all that sort of stuff. Whitewashed wall. Yeah. What's the allusion to there? What are we talking about, this whitewashed wall? We want the sepulchres to look right, so that you don't know that there's evil inside them, as it were. Because, you know, touching the bones and all that sort of stuff was taboo. Yeah. Paul mentions that when he's before the Sanhedrin Council, that the one thing that he brought up that maybe they might be accusing him of having hope. Yeah. Maybe.
Six.
Is it six? Yeah. Is this in 24?
No, it's 21.
21?
Yeah.
Verse 21? Oh, except it be for this one voice. Yeah. Okay. So that's in verse 21 is what I was looking for specifically here. Is that, or else let these men in verse 20 themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question before you this day. And interestingly enough, it is a few verses above that, and I had it just a minute ago, and I probably won't be able to find it again. But, in verse 15, it says, but verse 14, let's start. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call a sect, so serve I the God of our fathers, believing all things which are according to the law and which are written in the prophets, having hope toward God, which these also themselves look for, that there shall be a resurrection both of the just and the unjust. That's what got him in trouble in the Sanhedrin court. And he's saying that these people also believe in a resurrection of the just and the unjust. But if these were Sadducees, they didn't. Which leads me to believe that perhaps Ananias was a Pharisee. But we understood in our discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago that it appeared that at least at this time in Jerusalem, the Sadducees appeared to be the sort of the ruling class right now, or had a majority in the council or whatever. But it's interesting to note that Paul says that these people that are testifying here right now, they also believe in the resurrection. So I found that curiously interesting. All right. So he mentions that in verse 21 about the, well, if they have something to accuse me of, it's probably because I said, well, there's a resurrection from the dead, and they didn't like that. I'm surprised, kind of, that Felix even puts up with them until this time. It's just, you know, because it's already been mentioned that, I believe it's when Claudius Lysias wrote the letter, that I found that they were just accusing one another of things in their own religion and their own law. And he had done nothing worthy of death or bonds. So, yeah. And so, but Felix is listening to him, probably because he's a Roman citizen and he has the right to this trial. So, but once again, he, I think, clearly sees, and Felix certainly can clearly see, that yes, it's just disputations about their own religion and their own law, the law of God, actually. And then Paul reports as he's relating all these things that on the 11th day that they found out that they were going to kill him. I think this was not in his defense, was it? No, it's not. It's not part of the defense. But when we look at it, if we put the timeline together, also we realize that after the trial, quote unquote, by the Sanhedrin, that that evening, what happened after that evening in, what was it, 23:11? Someone spoke to Paul? Pardon? No. Yeah, first of all, yeah, the Lord spoke to him, saying, you're going to go to Rome. Okay. And then the next day, after that, then we have the nephew, right? So Paul is informed about that plot of the people that want to kill him. How many people? 40 people. They're still around today and very hungry. So, because they said they would not eat or drink until they kill Paul. And so, yeah, so it would probably make a good horror story of some sort. But
I'm just curious. You know, he starts off in 23 with his, and saying that he's lived in all good conscience and stuff like that, and then that's when he's, you know, they said slap him on the mouth. So did they know, I mean, you know, it's a small world at that time, did they know about his previous history?
You know, the thing is that I'm not sure how long this Ananias had been head chief priest. But you know that the chief priests and elders are the ones that sent him to Damascus to persecute the Christians. And so the council sent him. It probably wasn't the same council, but I would think that they would know about this, that this Saul of Tarsus was sent out.
So then he stands there saying that he's lived in good conscience, and that's appalling because it's like blasphemy. You know?
Right, okay. Right. So, you know, because Paul has told them, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. And he says, I've lived in all good conscience. And they're thinking, but you're a Christian. You've rejected the law of Moses. And you've told other people that they shouldn't baptize circumcise their children, such like as that. You know, that's some of the charges that were made against him originally that actually never came up in this discussion before the Sanhedrin. You know, and so, yeah, they're thinking, blasphemy here. You've given this up, and now you say that you've lived in all good conscience. You're just wrong. Smack him a good one. So they did. Yeah. All right. Now, as we go, continue along through these 12 days, then Paul's informed about the plot to kill him by his, what, nephew? And whose child is this? His sister's. All right. So, and as Mickey mentioned also, this is the first and only time we hear anything about Paul's family. So, very, very interesting that indeed we can come to the conclusion that Paul has a family. It's much like, you know, some denominations will say that, you know, Jesus was the only one born of Mary or something like that. I don't know what the whole thing is. But, you know, I was just reading through in my daily reading through. I believe I'm in Matthew in the New Testament. And it talks about it, by name, his four brothers. And it says, and all of his sisters are here, which means that there are at least three sisters. So there were at least eight children in this family. Jesus, of course, being the oldest. And you think, well, now how can you come to the conclusion that Mary had Jesus and that was it? So it's a bit strange. So, all right. How did I get off on that? I can't imagine. The nephew and, oh, that's what we were talking about, family. The nephew of Paul. And so in this instance, then, of course, we understand that the information ends up in the lap of the chief captain, who tells them to take 470 people and take them to Caesarea, to Felix, the governor, because he knows that he's a Roman. So that's the place where he needs to be judged, not in Jerusalem. The seat of judgment for Felix, who is the governor, would be in Caesarea, not Jerusalem. Jerusalem was just a place they went to when they needed to get some work done that pertained particularly to that. And they take him halfway to Antipatris, as we've already looked at, down on the coastal plain, about halfway between Jerusalem and Caesarea. And then on day 12, he gets to Caesarea, and at that time he's handed over to Felix. So what question does Felix ask him? What province are you from? And he says, Cilicia. And Felix says, okay, that's in my jurisdiction. Therefore, I'd be glad to sit down and judge you, you know. So give you a fair trial and then hang you. So so what do we got? About 5 seconds or something?
Well, we got 17.
17 seconds. Oh. So we'll probably go ahead and then leave this next chart to Mickey. So the one that says Paul states that he caused no trouble in the temple as he is so charged. So Mickey can start at that slide then next week. Thanks for your participation.